The following podcast is an Embassy Row production.
Hey, everybody. I'm Mark Lamont Hill, owner of Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books. I am a professor, a scholar, and most importantly, a book nerd. I say book nerd because I don't just love to read books. I'm the person who loves to read about the book. I love hearing authors talk about how and why they wrote the book, and I love talking to other book nerds about their favorite books. That's why I started Coffee and Books. It's a podcast all about books. Every episode, I sit down over a cup of coffee with the world's biggest authors to discuss the most interesting, controversial, fun, and important books. And sometimes I just hang out with experts, fans, and other special guests to talk about some of the greatest books of all time. And today, I have the pleasure of having with me a New York Times best-selling author. She is the author of a wonderful new book. It's called Professional Troublemaker, The Fear Fighter Manual. Lovie Jones is in the building. How you doing?
What's going on, sir?
It is good to see you. It's good to see you back with another successful book. I know the New York Times ain't the most important thing, but I'm like a book nerd, so I look at the ratings, I check people's stats, I see where people are selling, and there's so much energy about this new book on social media, on all the websites. You got to be proud of where you are.
Oh man, it's wild. Like it's blown my mind how people have just showed up for this book in such big ways.
Yeah, no, they've shown up big. But you know, before we talk about the book, we always start off with some coffee talk. So the first question is, what are you drinking? Because I am drinking right now a nice cappuccino. I don't usually do cappuccino because I don't like all the foam. But to be honest, okay, I was making myself a latte. And I put the steaming wand up a little too high for too long, so it turned into a cappuccino. So I just pretended that that's what I wanted the whole time. I don't put no flavors in it. I don't put nothing else in it, but it'll get me through my day. What are you drinking?
I am a hot chocolate girl with whipped cream, like full milk, whole milk, all that.
Oh my God. Okay. So I am a bit of a hot chocolate snob.
Mm.
I use pure cacao. I use whole milk.
Oh.
Sometimes I put some banana syrup in it. We make a banana hot chocolate, which is like the greatest thing ever made.
Banana hot chocolate.
Banana hot chocolate will change your life. Next time you come to Philadelphia, come to Uncle Bobby's and I will make you a banana hot chocolate. I promise it will make you not want hot chocolate, regular hot chocolate again.
I need that in my life. I need that.
I promise. It's going to change your life. But I got to say, we don't use whipped cream. I'm sort of there's an idea in high-end coffee shops that if you make hot chocolate, you can't use whipped cream. But the people love whipped cream. Everybody loves whipped cream.
I love whipped cream.
I don't, and I'm bougie, so I don't serve it. But if somebody wants it, you know what I mean? We can make it happen. So I'll even give you whipped cream for the banana hot chocolate if that's what you want.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm not bougie about my hot chocolate. I'm actually very basic about my hot chocolate taste because the high-end hot chocolates is usually made with dark cocoa.
Yes.
Which I don't like. I don't like dark chocolate. So I'm like, give me my milk chocolate joint.
You basically want like Swiss Miss.
Dog, listen, Nestle is my favorite. people have bought me Nestle and Ghirardelli.
Yeah.
Godiva, I've tried. I don't love it. I do like the basic hot chocolate still. I ain't gonna lie.
I feel bougie-er after talking to you about this because I'm like, oh my God, milk chocolate for your hot. You did a dark pure cacao. Oh my
God. No.
With no sugar, no. Oh my God.
Okay. Oh God, no. That sounds like disappointment. No.
And that's where the banana syrup comes in. I promise. It'll make it all magic. I mean, when I opened a coffee shop, I was drinking them like two a day. It was to the point that I was noticing. Yeah, because they were so good. And if y'all are coffee fans, you need some more caffeine. You can make it like a banana mocha, you know, so you put a little espresso in that thing, man. I'm telling you, you'd be writing four books.
Because I'll be hyped. I'll be super hyped.
Exactly. Right. But look, you don't need no help writing books because you write quickly, but you write thoroughly and you write really great books. And Professional Troublemaker is an interesting book. What made you want to write a book like this? Which is, it's not a self-help book, but it is kind of a manual for how to navigate this world in better ways.
Yeah, I was convicted to write this book after my TED Talk. So I did a TED Talk 3 years ago that now has 5 million views, over 5 million views. And Mark, I turned it down twice before I did it.
Why?
I was afraid that I wasn't ready. I was like, you know, TED is a massive stage and, you know, it takes a lot of effort to get on a TED stage. They run you through the ringer. If you're going to do an official TED Talk, like they get you a coach, they work through your script. It's a whole situation. And I was like, yeah, I ain't got time for that. Cause it was the year after my first book came out. And I was on the road already. Like I had 50 speaking engagements that year.
Wow.
I was like, oh, I can't do TED. I ain't got no time for that. And I don't want to get on that stage and bomb. So I turned them down and they came back again. And I was like, I actually have a speaking engagement booked for the date of TED. But 3 weeks before TED, you know, I was like, oh, I actually don't have to be in New York until the day after. So I was like, I'm going to go for a day to go cheer on my friends. I reached out to them and I said, hey, can I just get a day pass? And they said, if you can come, we want you to speak. 3 weeks before.
Ooh.
3 weeks. Where everybody else has already been finalized for like months. They've had their talks done. So I called my girl, Unique Jones Gibson, because I was about to turn them down for a third time. I said, call me crazy. I was like, tell me I'm crazy. They want me to do this TED talk in three weeks. And everybody else has already had their coach. They've already had their talk figured out. I'd have to come up with a brand new talk and all this stuff. And Unique straight was like, everybody ain't you.
Own that dopeness.
Own that dopeness. She literally was like, nah, I need you to get off my phone and go write this talk and kill it. And I did. And this talk has changed my life in ways I'm not even sure. I get notes every single day still from people who said they watched my TED talk and,
wow,
and what it did for them. Every single day. I've gotten countless speaking engagements from that talk. And I was like, yo, how often do we let fear stop us from doing what we're supposed to do? How often have we said no to yes opportunities in our lives because we were afraid, simply because we were afraid?
Wow.
And I was like, this is what my whole journey has been about. The moments when I've decided to move forward and be courageous, even when I was afraid, I've won. The moments when I've let fear stop me from doing that thing,
yeah,
I did not get the opportunity I was supposed to get, nor do the thing I was supposed to do. So that's why I wanted to write this because it's a story of so many of us.
So many of us are prisoner to fear, and you had the courage to break out of that. And you basically tell us how to do that. And you do it in a couple of ways, right? The first thing that you talk about is how to be, right? The first section of the book is about being. And some of the tips that you give us, I found incredibly helpful, including I was sort of joking when I said own your dopeness. But there's a way that you encourage us to kind of push back against some of the stereotypes, especially against Black women, to push back against some of the controlling images of us. You know, where they say Black women are too much, or you want too much, or she thinks she's too fly. And you're basically running toward that stuff and saying, no, own the dopeness, be too much, know who you are and be okay with that. Why is that so important?
I mean, the world is constantly telling us what we are, who we are, and telling us either we're too big or too aggressive or too Black, okay, to whatever that thing is. And that message will not stop coming.
Yeah,
it's not going to stop. Folks ain't going to stop telling us that we're not enough or that our lives need to be different or that we need to be different. And I think our superpower lies in that thing that's too much. Like when I was little, they used to say I talk too much. And now I make a good living and as a speaker. As a writer, right? Like we get to be good podcast hosts because we talk too much. And I'm like, yo, what happens if we stick to being the person we were before the world traumatized it out of us?
Mm.
Right? I think the truest version of ourselves is us around 7, 8, and 9, when we were audacious for no reason. Kids are just bold for no reason. You're like, you got some nerve. Yes, they do. And then what happens after that is that it gets abused out of us, insulted out of us, and told that it's not good. So then we look up and we've internalized all this stuff everybody's sending our way and we swallow down our superpower. We say that there's no room for it. But I'm like, what happens if we stay being the 8-year-old version of ourselves? Like who I am today is the 8-year-old version of me. I was the girl who got in trouble for her mouth. Like not because I was being disrespectful, but because I would always let somebody know whether or not they were older than me when they did something I didn't like.
Yeah.
I would walk up to my mama after she punishes me for something that I did or said, I'll take the punishment. And then I'll say, mom, I feel like you owe me an apology because that wasn't fair. And here's why. Like,
did you ever get that apology?
She'd be like, get out of my face. But she also didn't punish me for doing it. Right.
Mm.
I would come to her with like this thing that I said was not fair. And she'd be like, girl, go sit down. But it wasn't that she would like insult me out of it. She basically gave me the permission to be this person. So then whatever was happening, whatever messages I was getting outside, I didn't internalize it. And at the center of my book is my grandmother. And she's the other person I was watching who showed up as herself, was like, we all know a Black older woman who you can't tell nothing, who is uncheckable, who loves you deeply, but will also lambast you deeply, you know, in the next thing. So I was watching these women let me be me. I was watching them being themselves. And I ultimately committed to not letting the world tell me that I wasn't good enough.
Mm. You also committed to not letting the world tell you that your dreams were too big. This idea of dreaming audaciously was stunning to me. And you said something like, we got almost have a fear of having too much hope, right? That there's a way that we scale down even our hopes.
Yeah.
First of all, why do we do that? And why is it important to have these audacious dreams?
We scale down our hopes because we're like, if I put too much stock in it and it disappoints me, how let down will I be? So then we say, I can't want that thing. I won't get it. So we already start with the idea that we're going to fail at it. And I think about, and one of the examples that I use in the book, so let's say you go on vacation with your friends and you love the spot and you're like, oh my God, I love this hotel. What you will do is you'll be like, man, I should buy the mattress, right? That mattress, I slept good. I'm buy that mattress. There's a group of people who started having their friends go to these cabins in the mountains and they had such an amazing time that they looked around and they were like, we should buy the mountain. Not the mattress. They wanted to buy the mountain. The audacity to think a mountain could even be for sale. While we're thinking about buying the mattress, they're thinking about buying the mountain. And it's because, and they're white boys, of course, and it's because they've just never been told there's ceilings for them. So they don't even think in terms of limit.
Yeah.
It blew my mind, and it's called Summit. I've gone to a Summit event before. It blew my mind to think somebody thought, I can buy a mountain. And I'm like, I know I would have only thought about buying the mattress. So just the audacity to even dream.
I'd have been shook about the mattress depending on how much it costs.
Correct. I've been like, shit, maybe I'll buy the mug. Okay, let's buy a mug.
Right.
That we use. But they bought a mountain. I'm just like, yo. And they actually were able to buy it. So first is the audacity to think it was possible. And then they actually made it happen for $40 million. Powder Mountain is what it's called.
Mm.
And it happened. The world that we live in, honestly, is a result of people who had the audacity to dream. The fact that we can fly, somebody thought that was possible. Imagine 200 years ago, somebody being like, you know, the train is not fast enough. What if we can get around by just flying? And somebody was probably like, you're actually insane. You're nuts. And whenever I'm in a plane, I'm sitting there. There's always a moment where I'm like, I'm actually sitting in a can that's floating through the air right now. Somebody thought that was possible for it to happen. So I think we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to the world to think about tin cans flying in the sky.
Wow. And how do we think about that in relation to sort of not just individual goals, but collective goals, right? Because there's a way that buying a mountain, like you said, is some ultimate white male privilege, right?
Yeah.
You know, even the idea of wanting to control and dominate nature. But I also think about how, you know, but I think about how your book also helps us think about, it could be used to help us think about having more ambitious dreams for each other, like imagining worlds without violence or worlds without rape culture or worlds without. I mean, it's like, I think sometimes we're afraid to dream bigger, not just as individuals for our own individual lives, but also collectively and for society. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Because our own individual dreams spread out to the community. So imagine that one person who thought there's a way we can fly through the sky. Their dream has now allowed all of us to be able to do this thing. I do think us dreaming audaciously is community justice. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm able to expect more of my life, then you can see it and say, okay, if that's possible for her on a real level, then that's possible for me. So then that spreads out and everybody starts understanding we can actually build the world we want. Yes, that world that has no racism, the world without police, right? When we even talk about the idea of like abolish police and people are like, what do you mean? You gotta actually dream about a world where you don't need punishment for people to behave properly. All of that actually has community repercussions. Our individual lives have community repercussions. So when we ourselves decide to do something that feels bigger, it is with the idea that somebody else will benefit from it. For me, I always say like, when my first book was coming out, around that time, I couldn't even put a Black woman in my book proposal.
So true.
A Black woman's book could not exist because this was 6 years ago. It was 2015, February 2015, that I wrote my book proposal. And each book that I put in that was from a Black person in that time, my agent made me take it out because they were like, that didn't sell well. So you can't put that in there. So I knew, I was like, my dream is to be a New York Times bestselling author. So somebody will be able to put my book in their proposal to get them a big book deal. That was my dream for myself. Because I was like, that one dream that I can have for me can spread outward. And Mark, it happened. When I was going back for the deal for book two, I had meetings with 13 or 14 editors. And at least five of them said to me, your book is in every proposal that comes across our table. And that's why we actually have to dream audaciously, because our own wins can help other people win. And I know people have gotten 7-figure book deals with my book as a comparative title for theirs.
Wow, that's amazing. By the way, that book is called I'm Judging You, The Do Better Manual. Y'all should grab that too. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of other books too. Another thing you talked about was telling the truth. And what I appreciate about you is that you encourage us to tell the truth, to own our truth, to speak the truth, even when it's challenging. But you also don't offer some rosy Disney narrative about what happens. You acknowledge, look, sometimes you're going to tell the truth and shit ain't going to work out good for you.
Correct.
But why is it still important to do so?
It's important to do so because the world is a dumpster fire from people not telling enough truths to themselves, to other people. And in the rooms that we're in, a lot of people who are listening to you, Mark, are probably already doing this because that's who you are. You're a professional troublemaker, speaking truth to the power every day, using your platform in ways that you know sometimes can harm you professionally, but you do it anyway. And there's a lot of people who exist in the world who are not doing it, who are not showing up in a way that they should because they're like, well, that ain't my business, or, you know, that's not my job. But I'm like, if we're in a room, it's our job. It is. And it's not the people who are living paycheck to paycheck, who are in acute danger of being harmed, who aren't safe in their homes that we're asking to put themselves on the line and tell the truth. It's those of us who are comfortable, those of us who are of privilege in some way, class, ethnicity, location, shoe, all these different things that we have to be convicted to tell the truth. We have to be convicted to put more things on the line, like, because it just, who else will do it? Who else can do it if not us? Because we're always passing the baton to other people, like, oh, that person's going to do it. And then you look up and realize they didn't do it. Then why didn't you do it? Like, it's like everybody's looking for Superman to save the day. But I'm like, everybody got a red cape. You got your red cape. Use that.
Right. It's hard because there's so much at risk. And I think that there's the kind of social justice critique that needs to be made in terms of truth telling. Then there's also the truths that people need to state for themselves and for their own advocacy. And you talk about this in the book, this idea of asking for more. Again, both we think about asking for more collectively, but I want to talk about just at the individual level for a minute. So many of us are afraid to ask for what we deserve. So many of us are afraid to ask for what we need. I see it play out along racial lines, gender lines, and other lines as well. But there's also something uniquely, maybe not uniquely human, but there's something about watching people across the board struggle to ask to get their needs met. Why are we like that? And how do we get out of it?
We're like that because we've never been given permission to ask for more. We've been told, be good with what you have. And then just on a real practical business level, I know I was never told to negotiate. I found out probably maybe 7 years ago, 8 years ago, maybe. And the first offer is not the best offer. The first offer is not the offer you should say yes to. Ask for more. It's part of the actual game, but people are afraid of hearing no.
Right.
What if they say no? If they say no, you be all right. But if they say no, you still end up in the same place you were. So you didn't lose anything. Now, if they say no and say, I'm resigning the job, it actually costs them money. Looking for somebody else to replace you for the job that they thought you were perfect for is going to now cost them more money. Most companies are not going to do that. They're not going to take away a job offer just because you said, I want more of it. And I think for women especially, like, we have been given guilt around wanting money. People think,
absolutely.
Say, I am a woman who wants to build wealth. Somebody's like, oh my God, you're being greedy. 95% of the world's billionaires are men because men have been given permission. Like, you're told your job is to collect money, get money. We've been told our job is to serve. But how can I be of service to the world when I don't have money, which runs the world? How can I be of service to the world if I can't pay my bills? So it is a form of economic justice for women to actually be successful. Because when women get money, we use it for good. We use it for service. How much money has Oprah given away? How much? Mackenzie Scott, who just got divorced from Jeff Bezos and got $50 billion. I think Mackenzie has given away something like $10 billion in like 2 years.
Wow.
Women will spend our money for the greater good of the world. Men will hoard money. So we actually have to start being like, being successful. Don't put guilt around it. Yes, I want money. Why? Because when I get more money, I hire more people who are marginalized. I hire women, I hire Black people. So I'm like, me getting money now will fund other people who look like me. And that keeps money going in a way that's really good.
What does it mean to fire yourself?
Ooh, the superwoman complex, yo. the superwoman and Superman complex is real, where we think we can do everything. You've seen that quote on the internet where everybody's like, you got the same 24 hours as Beyonce. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you absolutely don't. Beyonce has 300 hours. Why? Because she has all these people who help her do the things that she does. You have 24 hours and you think you can be mom, teacher, CEO, accountant, project manager, and then you feel guilty. Like, we have to fire ourselves from the things that we don't have to do. Don't feel guilty about having a housekeeper come and clean your house. If they can save you 2 hours out of your week, that's 2 hours you can be spending resting, helping the kids, or just being, right? Doing whatever you want to do. Fire yourself without the guilt. And we can't do everything ourselves. We're not supposed to. So I'm over here like, who can I hire to do what? Like,
how hard is that for you though? Because I know you type A. So how hard is that?
Yeah, it's a practice. Let me tell you, I wrote this book for myself because some of these chapters are reading me for filth. Because firing myself, especially in my own company, is tough. I want to be in everything. I want to be like, where is that happening? What's going on there? Do y'all need me to do this thing? And they're like, mind your business, lady. Mind your business. This ain't your job. My team started firing me because I wasn't firing myself. They'll have meetings. They'll have meetings I have no clue about. And then come to me and say, here's what we're doing. I'd be like, oh, okay, cool. Because they were able to be more productive. You know, it's hard to trust people to do stuff because you are afraid of them dropping the ball on your behalf, right? But you got to understand that, okay, if they do drop the ball, everything is not catastrophic. So yesterday, for example, Mark, when you hit me up and said, I want you on the show, and we were in DMs, for a hot second there, I was going to actually like schedule it, put it on my calendar myself. And I was like, my assistant is going to be like, what is this new thing? Why didn't you tell me? Why am I not the one? So I said, Mark, please email my team.
That's true. You did do that. That's gross.
I had to fire myself.
I think that is a perfect example. And it's also a lesson to me because I followed through with the booking, put it on my own calendar and did all the things. And sometimes at the end of the month, and people ask me, don't you got somebody for this? Don't you need an assistant? Like, I have one. Like, you need a producer, another producer. I got one. They're all great. I just cut them out because I want to control it. And so I end up doing it. And then I end up complaining about how overworked I am.
It is a practice for all of us, especially those of us who are running our own companies, especially those of us who are creatives who like we have relationships, right? So we're like, you know, I don't want the person to feel funny that I'm sending them to my assistant. So Mark, how yesterday should have gone for both of us is you hit me up on DMs and say, yo, come on the show. And I go, I bet. And you go, all right, give me your email. My assistant will hit you, your assistant up. And we're going to make sure it happens for tomorrow, right? Where you can make the initial, what's up? I want you on the show. And I'm like, absolutely. So then from that point, everybody else handles it. And then we just see each other, right? We got to cut ourselves because honestly, we are the bottleneck.
Right. I got to do that. All right. One more thing. Why do people need a Nigerian friend? I read that and cracked up.
Yo, because Nigerians are just most chill deficient. We just hype all the time. We just hype all the time for no reason. We will gas you up for no reason. But that's the diaspora thing, right? But Nigerians specifically, man, we walk with so much like gumption all the time because we come from a country of people who are constantly, where in Nigeria, for you to get anything, you have to work. There is no middle class in Nigeria. It's either dumb rich or stupid poor. So people are striving every day, but the way people carry themselves, even the person who's at the market, who doesn't know where she's going to get her food from, is asking you to get out of her way because you have the nerve to stand in her way. So Nigerian friends bring that to your life. We just, you know, we got mouth. We will fight for you, right? And we can play Dirty Dozens all day.
Facts.
All day.
Facts.
Okay, we roast each other like it's nothing. We honestly can hurt people's feelings very quickly. And we'd be like, what happened? I didn't say nothing.
It's the subtle burn. So let me ask you, who are you reading these days? Who are the writers that inspire you? Who do you enjoy reading?
You know what's funny? Right, lately I've been reading books by therapists. I've been reading, I love Esther Perel's stuff. She's actually gonna be on my tour. Esther Perel writes about like life in a real way. And she's a psychologist, so it's all data-based. One of the really good novels that I read recently is one called Welcome to Lagos, written by a Nigerian woman. Yeah, that one's good. Let me see.
I haven't read that yet. Right now.
Oh, it's good. I have Cast on my bookshelf right now on my to-do list. Isabel Wilkerson.
Oh, yeah. That's classic.
Yeah.
It's an instant classic.
Instant classic. You know what's funny? Around book time, I actually don't read a lot of books.
I get it. Like, you put all that time into it while you're writing a book and you're crashing and you're looking for all the stuff. And then when you're on book tour, you almost only have time to be in the moment. You know what I mean? And you're still thinking about your project. So I'm going to take you back a step before we go with a game that we play. It's a game that brings great joy to me as the host. And it typically brings great pain and frustration to the guest, which brings even greater joy to me as the host. The game is called Buy It, Borrow It, or Burn It. I'm going to give you three books. Mm. One you can buy, one you can borrow, one you got to burn.
Okay.
These are the three books. First book, Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower by Brittany Cooper. Mm-hmm. Second book, One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race by Yaba Blay. And third, We're Going to Need More Wine by Gabrielle Union.
Dog, you are a savage, yo. Like,
I'm a professional troublemaker.
You a savage for that. Yo, what? That's not even cool. Like, that's violence, yo. Like,
yeah, I know. I woke up this morning and chose violence. Exactly.
You chose violence. Goddamn.
And so just for those that don't know, I'm, and again, we've had all of these people on the show except Gabrielle, who will come on soon, I hope. Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower is a wonderful book by Brittany Cooper, who was on the show a few months ago. One Drop, Yaba Blay was on just a few weeks ago talking about her wonderful book of photo essays on race. And Gabrielle Union, We're Going to Need More Wine, is just a fun-ass, funny, cool-ass book. Yes.
Yo, this is so rude. Can I refuse? Like, no. What? Okay. I'm going to go backwards then.
Okay.
I'm going to go backwards. My choice is based on drop date. So I'm a buy one drop.
Okay.
I'm a borrow, We Need More Wine. Mm-hmm. And then I will burn Eloquent Rage. I did backwards order from when they came out.
I hope you remember that defense of yourself when everybody finds out. There's no safe way out. You can talk all that. I did it in chronological order, shit you want. I'm going to pipe this up on the internet.
Dog, you're so freaking. Why you got to choose? I'm going to be like, see what happened was.
Right.
What happened was.
It's all good. It's all good because they all went through it. Brittany went through it. I had Brittany burning an Audre Lorde book. And Yab, I made her pick between like Chantrell. I made her pick between like Joe Morgan and like.
I think maybe
Brittany. I'm a monster. I'm a terrible person.
You're a monster.
Yeah, but it made me see how fun this is for me. I told you.
I see.
Lovey, how can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, I am all over the internet. I'm at Lovey is my username on all these platforms.
It's LUVVIE.
I.E. Two V's, not two U's. Because sometimes people put two U's and I'm like, no.
Nope.
And people can learn more about my book and come on my book tour, professionaltroublemakerbook.com. Gabrielle is actually one of my conversation partners. I just did one with Kev on stage. I got Brittany Packnett Cunningham is another person on my tour. Malik Teal, Kalana Barfield Brown. So yeah, people can find out about that, but I'd be around. I'd be on these interwebs.
She's everywhere on these interwebs. Her book is everywhere. Make sure you check out the new book, Professional Troublemaker, The Fear Fighter Manual. You can get it anywhere books are sold, but we like you to get it at bookshop.org/shop/Uncle Bobby's. You can get all the books we talked about. We are New York Times reporting, and we will make sure that your book is as successful as it can be because it's an amazing book. And just, I wish you all the luck, but all the success. And we're just so proud of everything you've been doing.
Thank you so much. And send me, I'm going to do a swipe up in that link so people can go ahead and order from Uncle Bobby's. Like, shout out to you for that. That's epic.
Oh, man, I'm so grateful for it. And we got coffee and books. So y'all know about the books. As COVID ends, we're going to do the coffee thing some more. And Lovey is going to come up to Philadelphia and get this banana hot chocolate. I may even dip into my hood bag and get some whipped cream to put on the hot chocolates on Lovey Jones Day at Uncle Bobby's, all right?
Yes, indeed.
Lovey, I see you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coffee and Books is a production of Embassy Row. Our executive producer is Sarni Rogers. This episode was produced by Karis Nelson. The show was edited by Maureen Bigas. And you can follow me on Instagram at Mark Lamont Hill and the show on Instagram at Coffee and Books Show. Catch you next week.